Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
There's a long list of reasons why people enjoy hunting. But did you know that hunting can also help people? Can make a difference in your community? Can even save lives? On this episode, we're going to talk about what I believe is one of the most important programs in the hunting world today. Hey, and welcome back to another episode of the New Hunter's Guide, the podcast and YouTube channel helping new hunters get started and helping active hunters learn new things. Today, I want to share with you guys something that I am really passionate about. There is a cause here. There's an organization. There's something involved that I believe every single hunter in the nation and beyond, wherever you're listening to this, needs to know about, needs to be aware of, and needs to engage with and get involved with at some point in your hunting career. Now, with me today to help tell that story is Josh Wilson. Josh is the executive director for Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry. He's also a lifelong hunter. He's very active in various degrees and places of ministry. And him and his family have been championing this cause nationwide in order to help people and communities, to help people across the nation, to connect with hunters, to do things that are just absolutely critical. So, Josh, it is great to have you on the show today. How are you doing, sir?
Hi, George. I'm doing great and appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get into the details and all of that, why don't you tell us a little bit about the story? You know, how did this thing happen? How did this get off the ground? Where did Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry come from? And then we'll talk a little bit about what you guys do and what the opportunities are for hunters around the nation to get involved and to help people and everything that goes with that.
Yeah, sure thing. Be happy to. Well, this movement, this organization that we're part of, ministry, is something that started almost 25 years ago as my dad was on his way to a farm where we did a good bit of hunting while I was in my college years back in the early mid-90s. In the state of Virginia. And he was on his way to the farm that day, I don't think to hunt, but to celebrate the landowner's birthday and to do some work around the farm. A lot of folks that hunt know that if you have property that you've arranged to hunt on, that it's always good to offer to help out throughout the year with things that are needed on the property. It builds good rapport and relationship with that landowner. So the folks that were part of that property were headed to the farm that day to do that. And on his way there, it's kind of wild because growing up, I don't ever remember this happening to us as a family, but he noticed a lady stopped along the roadside. Her car was pulled over and she was outside of the car. And so he, for whatever reason, decided to stop and see what the situation was, see if he could help. And he got out and walked over to her and she said, could you come over here and help me? And he was cautious. He wasn't sure the whole circumstance here that led to her situation, but he said, sure, what's going on? And she motioned over to the side of the road and showed him a small buck that was laying there. And he quickly could see that, oh, this is a deer that was hit by a car. And so he thought, well, maybe she hit it, and asked, are you okay? Is your car okay? Oh, she said, I'm fine. I didn't hit it, but I saw it here. Would you help me load it into my trunk? And he said, well, we really should get this tagged. Back in those days, even roadkill needed to be tagged in most states, either by a police officer or a wildlife division officer. And she said, well, no, I'm not really worried about that. I just need to get this in my car. Would you help me? So he said, sure, I can do that. Would you like me to field dress it for you? Make it easier for you if you're taking it home. She said, no, that I used to do that, and it just made a mess in my trunk. I'd really rather just get it home where my kids and I can deal with it. They're hungry, and I need to get this food to them. So he realized he was asking too many questions, and what she really just needed was his help. So he lifted the deer up with her. They put it in the trunk. She thanked him, closed the trunk, and drove off. And he just stood there, kind of puzzled by this experience, because again, I don't think this was a typical kind of everyday thing for him. And I certainly don't remember stopping and helping folks along the road, or even really seeing this type of scenario unfold. So he was wondering, well, gee, what does this mean? And what really struck him was the words that Jesus shared in Matthew 25, when he was talking about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and taking care of the poor, visiting those in prison and so forth, and told his followers that basically when you do these things for others, even for the least of these others, you've done it to me. And so it just struck him right then and there that he had encountered the Lord Jesus in this situation, because he had assisted this woman. And then he kind of felt bad, like, well, maybe I don't even have her name or number, how we could help her. So he went on to the farm and shared the experience with the folks there. And their first question was, well, Rick, did you get a name? Did you get a number? Is there a way we can seek her out, maybe offer some more assistance? And he didn't. And so they had a good time with that. Well, what good are you? You couldn't even follow up with her. But they said, well, we do know about this program here in Virginia called Hunters for the Hungry. We had some material that one of us got in the mail. Maybe it's time we start looking at how we could donate some of the extra deer we harvest here on the property to that program. And even if it doesn't help the woman that you encountered directly, maybe it would. Maybe she'd end up at one of the food banks to get some help. But even if not, at least we can take this experience of yours and put it into action, helping the people of the community here around the farm in Virginia. And so they did. We did. I remember afternoons, getting a deer and knowing that we already had one back in the freezer, or that we weren't going to get home to Maryland in time to get it to one of the butcher shops that we typically would use. And so we'd look on the list and find the local butcher that participated there near the farm and take the deer there to donate to the Hunters for the Hungry program. And so he started thinking, well, we should be able to do the same kind of thing at home in Maryland, where we hunt and other friends hunt. And there was a program here that some different groups had organized prior to that time. And I think at that point, our Department of Natural Resources was running it. It worked a little differently. The Virginia program gave the opportunity for a hunter to donate and didn't have to pay. You didn't have to pay any of the processing bill, because the organization was raising money to pay those bills and take care of getting the meat delivered or offered up to a food pantry. In Maryland and in some other states, the hunter had to pay part of the bill. Here it was sort of a cooperative deal where I think you would pay half of the price and then the state was going to reimburse the butcher the other half of their processing bill. But Dad thought, there's got to be a way that we could do something in Maryland more like what Virginia does. I think there would be more deer donated if the hunter didn't have to pay the bill. And we could probably just do more with it and really provide more meat to the local agencies. So I talked with our pastor. This would have been in 1997, getting ready for hunting season, and said, could we do a program? And he described what Virginia had and said, I don't really have an organization other than our church to work with. Could this become a ministry of our church this fall? And the pastor liked the idea and kind of became his partner in getting it all set up. They ran it by the church leadership. They were in agreement. And so at that point, it was, I think he just called it Hunters Feeding the Hungry. And so it was a ministry of our church, and they partnered with several butchers that we had known, that he had known for many years here in the county, and ran it just like in Virginia. They went out and looked for financial support. And then the church used that to pay the bills for the donated deer. The butchers were happy with how it worked, and they had a good first season. Then he got a call one day from the Maryland DNR Division of Wildlife, and they asked if he would come to a meeting in Annapolis. And this is kind of a funny story in itself. He felt like he probably had done something wrong, misunderstood some wildlife law that prevents you from doing this kind of thing in the state. So he was concerned that he was going to be shut down right after having that first successful season. But he said he put on his best suit. He wanted to look the part. He headed to Annapolis for this meeting and sat down in an office. And they said, you know, it's nice to meet you, Rick. You started a program there in Western Maryland. We saw a news article, and something that surprised us about your results were that you had as many deer donated in your county as the program that we've been running had donated across the entire rest of the state. And so we were just curious about that to learn more about what you were doing and maybe what makes it different. And so he said, well, I tell you, there's two things really. One is that we learned what we're doing from the program in Virginia, where they raise the money to pay the bills, whereas the program you guys have been running asks the hunter to pay like $25 part of the bill. And secondly, we're a faith-based Christian ministry, so we're asking the Lord to bless this and to take it as far as He'd like it to go. And I don't think you guys are able to do that with the state program. And to his surprise, they kind of eased the door shut and went around the room, and each person there identified like what church they were part of, what their faith background was. And they said, we were wondering about all that, and we like what you're describing, and it sounds really, really good to us. So would you like to just take the list of butchers we've been working with and some of the other contacts we have and expand your program across the rest of the state? So he said, well, I wasn't really anticipating that, but we could work in that direction. So that's kind of how it got its start, going across our state of Maryland. And from there, it just grew. As a lifelong hunter and competitive archer, Dad had a lot of relationships in the industry, and he was able to share it with people that then at that point were owners of companies, outdoor writers, things of that nature. And so it started to get some coverage in that way, some attention, and we would get contact from hunters in other states. Much like Dad learned from the Virginia program, they were looking at what he was doing and saying, hey, I'd like to do this in Ohio or Indiana. Could you help me? And so we helped other folks get started. And from that point, it just continued to grow. And now we, you know, it's kind of had its ups and downs over the years in terms of size and scope and geographic coverage. But as it stands today, here close to 25 years later, we have about 90 volunteer coordinators that are signed on with our program. And they work in about 15 different states. We're pretty big in Maryland and Ohio, have pretty much full state coverage there. And then other states where we have a handful of volunteers that run chapters, and it works pretty well. So here we are 25 years later, and folks just like Dad and we did back in Virginia in the 90s, folks have the opportunity to donate a deer in their community that will make its way in the form of nutritious meat to a local food bank or soup kitchen to help people in need, much like the lady that he encountered originally along the roadside.
So then it all started with one single mother that had a need, a personal encounter with a real need, and then just that ball started rolling. And, you know, the further you guys went, you realize the need is bigger than just that person or a couple local people. You know, how big is the need really? I don't think most people give much thought to that.
Well, it's tremendous. You can look up statistics about the need for food assistance, and people can debate who truly is in need, who isn't. We try not to get off into those discussions and debates. I mean, as believers and followers of the Lord Jesus, we feel that we're just called to help when someone presents a need. So, but it's millions and millions, regardless of what statistics you're looking at, millions and millions of our fellow Americans, including families and many children, have difficulty sourcing enough food. And whether that's due to just their situation in general, or something like COVID that struck 2 years ago, I guess we're going on, or maybe almost a year and a half, 2 years ago, leading to reduced hours, businesses closing for a time, and affecting many, many jobs. Regardless of the cause, we just have a lot of people in our country that struggle. And I tell you, there's people around us and maybe around you and the listeners that maybe don't see or encounter this need every day, but it is real. I remember when one of my, I guess it was a principal in our school district, told the story that he was, when he was an assistant principal, there was a young boy in the lunchroom that was eating one day, and he was just, I guess you would say, eating like a pig. There's really no other way to describe it. He was eating quickly. He was making a mess. Other kids were kind of pointing and laughing about it. And he looked at it as a behavior issue initially, and approached this young man and warned him about this and said, you can't eat like this. You have to eat, you know, like everybody else. You get foods all over the place. Come on, clean up your act. And he came back around later, same problem, different day, same problem. So I said, all right, to the office. And when the lunch shift ended, he went over to talk with him, see if he could figure out what's going on, how they could resolve this. And he said, could you tell me why you eat like this? And he looked at this man, the assistant principal, and said, I'm sorry, sir, but I'm hungry. And he said, well, I'm hungry too. I have to watch all of you eat through three lunch shifts before I get to sit down and eat. You're going to have to come up with something better than that. And he said, well, again, I'm sorry, but last night wasn't my turn to eat.
Oh, wow.
And that just changed the entire story. You know, it flipped a 180 degree right there. And he realized that he was dealing with something, not a behavioral issue, but behavior that was coming out of a need that he didn't even know existed in this family. So I only tell that story to say that, you know, I think I go through my day in many times, many ways, oblivious to the needs of others around me, even people that look like they're doing fine, but may go home to a situation where they're deciding whether they can grocery shop that evening or need to pay for the prescriptions that had been filled or need to pay that rent check. And it's just not always easy.
I think I saw recently that somewhere around 1 in 7 children in the United States, they do not know where their next meal is coming from.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, that's, again, a statistic I think comes out of the, like the USDA when they're dealing with things, what they call food security. And so it just has to do with, you know, surveying people and doing statistical analysis. But yeah, it's a number that, you know, it might not be every night, but certainly they have some criteria where there's a regular occurrence of this child or this family not having enough food to meet their nutritional needs. And in childhood in particular, we know that that's very crucial when physically and mentally development is taking place in the body. If nutrition is a factor and malnutrition is a factor, then you've got problems with growth that can even affect learning and education. So it's just a crucial time to try to make sure we're helping as many people and families as we can have adequate nutrition, and that includes, in big large part, protein. Our food banks and food pantries are often in great need of protein items. There's a lot of donation of cereal and pasta, you know, shelf stable things, canned goods, soups, and so forth. But when it comes to fresh or frozen meat, poultry, beef, things like the venison that's donated through our program, it's usually not readily available. It can be expensive. You know, stores want to sell as much of that as they can. And then when it reaches sort of an end of shelf life type deal, that's not really a food that can be donated in the same way as some of the dry goods. So yeah, there's usually a great need for meat items and protein.
Wow. And you know, this is not just affecting families in certain underdeveloped areas, but this is affecting families, you know, across the board, people living in subdivisions, people living, you know, across the country, especially in the last year and a half where there's been a lot of, you know, financial troubles and things like that that have happened. But of course, this dates back well before, you know, it doesn't take much. You've got a family where, you know, the father and mother, they're doing well. They have a nice house. They got a good family. They've got good vehicles. One of them loses their job. Either they can't collect unemployment, or it's just not enough, or it runs out before they're able to secure something else. And now all of a sudden that family barely has enough to keep the lights on. And, you know, they're not able to get sufficient food or quantity of food. Could be for a short period of time, hopefully. You know, nothing long term, but it could be long term. It could change the course of their life forever. They get thrown out of their house. They have to move. They go through a long season of just not able to find food for their family that's nutritious or enough at all. And they, you know, like you mentioned, you go to a food bank and you go to places like this that thank God are available to help. But after a while, it's like, okay, well, you need substantive food. If all that's available is, you know, certain things that are, you know, we would consider them, you know, any normal day, yeah, that's fine to eat that. But if all you're eating day and night is ramen noodles, for example, you reach a point where, one, it's not just that you get tired of it, but your body is not able to gain the nutrients that it needs from that food, and it can cause, you know, significant health issues in a prolonged state of time.
Right, right. I mean, I love a Pop-Tart, or maybe I can't say that. What would we call it? A rectangular breakfast pastry in a box as much as the next guy. But, you know, if I had to eat that day in, day out, eventually my body would be telling me this isn't working. We need something else.
Right, right. So tell everybody a little bit about, just in the simplest terms, you know, how does this program work? If you wanted to donate a deer or, you know, an elk or, you know, another large game animal, you know, how does this actually happen? You wake up in the morning to go hunting, deer walks out in front of you, you take the shot, you get it, and then what happens?
Sure. Well, ideally, the person in that scenario would have already checked ahead of time if they're thinking of donating an animal to help others, to see if either our organization or a different similar organization is active in their area. And by active, that would mean has a butcher shop in place that's participating with the program, where they could take that deer, that elk, and say they want to donate it to feed the hungry. And then in that scenario, the butcher would probably have some paperwork for them, just like a small spot on a log sheet, maybe, for their contact info and deer tag number, just for accountability, you know, so that the organization paying the bills knows that that deer was donated, that at least there's some record of something, you know, that the person was actually there and had a tagged deer or elk. So they would take it, the processor would accept it, and that would be it for the hunter in that circumstance. The processor would then put that through their regular routine. They would get the meat cut, wrapped, and frozen, and then they would put it aside with other donated animals, the meat from other donated animals, until they have a batch ready for one of the local food banks or ministries that they're partnered with. And then typically the butcher will either call either the organization that they're working with, like our Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry or other similar group, or the group, the organization may have that butcher linked up directly with a food pantry or food bank that they would call and let them know they have a batch ready. And usually within a day or so, that agency would come out, pick up the meat, and it would be in their freezer with their other food items ready for distribution to families or use as part of the meal to make tacos or spaghetti sauce for the soup kitchen that evening and for upcoming days and weeks. And then as far as the cost for paying the butcher, the butcher would then work up a bill and sends it to the organization they're working with, like ours, and we pay it using funds that have been raised usually in that community, but sometimes from other grants and things that we're able to secure nationally through the volunteer coordinator that we have in that area. So everything for us kind of works through a coordinator. They're the ones that partner with or kind of recruit these butchers that would like to participate. They work out the arrangements on the cost, asking them for a discount, which we usually get like 20% or so off of the normal cost that they would charge the hunter. And then that person, that coordinator, also works to raise financial support through personal asks, sometimes through events or fundraisers, drawings, prize drawings, auctions, things like that. Community grants or grant programs that sometimes churches and other groups might have, civic organizations. So they gather that support and we hold on to that until it's time to pay the butcher. And so that coordinator then gets the bills from the butcher and sends them on into us. And then we send the payment back out to the butcher. So I think that's all the steps. It's kind of like a loop or a repeating cycle. And this just goes on. You know, the most activity, of course, is during hunting season, although we do see some donations if the butchers are open and available to process the meat off season. There can be deer donated from crop damage or other types of management permits that the state wildlife division or DNR may offer in that particular state. But it's generally concentrated into the hunting season. We do see some livestock donations throughout the year in some places if farming and or ranches are prevalent. But yeah, that's how it works.
So then you have a person who they've got a heart for this cause. They've got a heart for feeding people in their local community. They're sensitive to the need. Whether they're a hunter or a non-hunter, they contact you guys. You've got materials and training and resources. They become a volunteer coordinator. So then they go and they identify butcher shops who are willing to participate and process the meat. And then they go and they talk to churches and businesses and community organizations and nonprofits, you know, to find people to fund that local program in those local butcher shops. And then they coordinate getting the meat back and forth and the financial factor with you guys. And then when it comes to the hunters, they take the deer or the elk or whatever the case may be. They take it to the butcher shop, drop it off, and that's it. That's all they need to do. The coordination and the details are taken care of by the coordinator. The finances are taken care of usually by the local organizations. And it just sort of works like clockwork from the hunter's standpoint. And at the same time, those people that are, you know, donating the resources to help make it possible, you know, they work on their side behind the scenes. But everything just sort of, it's like there's two or three different spheres of operation that make all this happen, right? So no one has to worry about what the other people are doing. They just do their part and then it's done.
Yep, that's correct. And we do have hunters that get involved as volunteers or in some cases, it's a hunter that becomes the coordinator. Maybe they contact us and they find that we don't already have anything going in their area, or we don't have another organization we're aware of that we could refer them to participate with. And so they decide it's time to get it started, much like Dad did almost 25 years ago for their community.
Great. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, you guys aren't trying to pretend like you're the only ones out there doing this. There's lots of other good organizations that are doing this work in different states and different areas. And maybe, you know, like in my state of Pennsylvania, we've got Hunters Sharing the Harvest, great program. They do a lot of the similar things that you guys do. They're pervasive throughout the state, but they're not everywhere. And, you know, if a hunter's got to drive 2 or 3 hours after, you know, a long day out in the field to drop off a deer, that's just probably not likely to happen. So there's opportunities, you know, all across the nation to make sure that there's something like this within driving distance, reasonable driving distance of, you know, anyone who's hunting that, that might be willing or able to donate something.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we don't pretend we're the only organization. You know, Dad learned about it from Virginia. And those folks, they didn't even take credit for it. They said that the director down there in Virginia, he'd say, I read some article back in the 80s about a group in Texas that was doing this. So it's really hard to pinpoint where it started. I think, again, back in the maybe the 1980s, I think if you look back, Safari Club was encouraging their chapters and their people to be involved with donation and may have started organizing some things with local butchers. But in reality, we all know that it's not an organization that started this concept. Hunters have been providers for their community, for their neighbors, for their family, really throughout history. So farming, hunting, and I guess you could throw in gathering, those have been the means for food production and securing the nutrition needed throughout human history. So we're really just taking what's already been going on and happening, and in a modern sense, just organizing it, giving it some intentionality and a process that people can use. And yeah, it works pretty well.
And I noticed on your website, you guys have, you know, farmer or FHFH.org, you guys have a lot of stories and testimonies and, you know, kids that are out on their first hunt and they decided, you know, the first deer that they shot, they wanted to donate that to help feed other kids in their community. And just, you know, tearjerker after tearjerker of people, you know, just making extraordinary decisions, often, you know, even as children. And of course, you know, adults as well, and especially those that are new hunters, just deciding, you know what, I want this to be a part of what I do. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm out in the woods, I'm having fun, I'm enjoying this, but I want it to count. I want it to help other people also. I want this to mean something in my community. And they're reaching out and doing something beyond themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say that's one of the big wins in all of this that maybe we didn't fully anticipate was this idea of another generation watching mom and dad donate animals to feed those in the community that are struggling. And then deciding when they get their first deer, you know, this son or daughter and mom or dad says, so how much jerky are we going to get? Or how much sausage? How do you want to get this made up? And they say, oh no, we're not keeping this one. We're donating this one just like you do, because I want to help people like you do, mom, or like you do, dad. Yeah, that's, I tell you what, that makes it all worthwhile, because yeah, we do this to glorify God, to help those in need primarily. But oftentimes I think it's those that are participating as hunters, as volunteers, that maybe are impacted just as much, if not more, by their involvement in the whole thing.
You know, that's so awesome. I did not grow up as a hunter. I didn't have a rich hunting tradition in my family, and, you know, was just never had anything like this in my life until, you know, I became an adult and just decided that I needed to press into, you know, the hunting world for all the reasons I've talked about on previous episodes and you know, some of the early episodes. But, you know, thinking that this could be an example that parents, that adults set, whether you're new to hunting, whether you've been hunting all your life, you know, you can set an example for the next generation to help people, to take this sport. For most of us, it's a sport. Most of us are not hunting to eat. You know, I mean, we like the meat, we keep it. I do lots of episodes and even videos on how to cook it, because it is outstanding meat, some of the highest quality you can get. But at the same time, we could go and buy that meat. You know, we're not fooling ourselves to think we're doing this to survive most of the time. There are some situations, of course, but to think that we could then, you know, by example, show the next generation that, hey, you know, there's other people that they're not able to do this. They don't have the resources. They don't have the know-how. They don't have the opportunities. They can't think past, you know, what are we going to have for dinner tonight or for breakfast tomorrow? And how many times can my kids eat this week? and we're able to help them and do something for them, and the kids see it and grow up with that and have that in their heart, I think is just, that in and of itself makes it worth doing, just teaching those lessons and modeling that for children. It's just incredible.
Absolutely. Yep. Couldn't agree more.
So then, you know, you all this on the hunting side, and, you know, maybe not everyone's aware, but in some states, you know, archery season opens maybe even the 1st of September. In some states, it goes until maybe the end of January. So there's a good, you know, however many months that is, 5 or 6 months worth of hunting season that's out there. But the meat gets frozen, so it can be utilized longer than the hunting season. Although, as I understand it, most food banks and those that are, you know, handing out, this stuff goes pretty quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, usually it does. We've heard from food bank directors and coordinators that there are people that grow to appreciate the venison so much that when it is available, becomes available, a load comes from the butcher shop, they come right away. They contact others that they know, get assistance at the same location, and let them know that the venison's there. And so, yep, it's, you know, you'd think that maybe people that didn't grow up enjoying wild game meat in their food and in their meals would be skeptical or have an aversion, but it sounds like most of the times that I've talked with food bank directors about this, that it's quickly overcome, that some food banks will offer samples. They'll be like, well, take a small amount with your other items here and see what you think. And very frequently those folks are ready for a full batch the next time they come.
And, you know, you're in no ways providing an inferior product to people. I mean, you know, the venison that's going out there is of the same or oftentimes even higher grade quality, you know, meat than what you're getting in a supermarket in terms of beef and some other things that are fattier, that, you know, who knows what else might be included with them. And so many times, you know, the animals coming out of the field, it's the highest quality meat you can get. And the butchers, you know, that's one of the reasons it's so important to go through butchers, isn't it? Because those folks, they know what's good, what's not good, what parts aren't good. And they're not sending just garbage out. You know, you guys talk to the butchers and, you know, you've got a relationship there where it's, you know, don't send anything to the food banks that you and your family wouldn't eat, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And we aim and try to work with butchers that are either state or USDA certified. So these are places that are also doing livestock, sometimes slaughtering, sometimes custom butchering on site. And we do also work with some game processors on a case-by-case basis, and there's certainly nothing wrong with game processors. Many hunters use them, and that's fine, and they do great work. But since we're talking about public meat distribution through food banks to people that weren't involved in hunting for the deer, weren't involved in picking the butcher that was going to process it, we just try to make sure that those we work with are experienced, that they learned the trade professionally, they've been in business for a while, there haven't been any known issues among their customers or problems with the meat that they've gotten, that they've got a good setup in place to do it. So yeah, you know, whether it's a game processor or all the way up through the USDA or state inspected places, we make sure that the folks doing it, to the best of our knowledge, are trained and equipped to do it right, do it well. And just as you said, we tell them if something comes in the door that you wouldn't feed to your family or your friends, just discard it. You know, we hate to see something go to waste, but we would hate even more for somebody to get food that's not wholesome.
Right. Absolutely. And I just want to share a little bit about, you know, my story with this. I came up never knowing programs like this existed. And, you know, I would take deer after deer, year after year to the butcher shop. And I noticed there was a little, you know, little symbol or badge or whatever that they hung there at the butcher shop door that mentioned they were part of Hunters Sharing the Harvest or one of the programs that are similar. And for years, I had no idea what that even meant. And in fact, it wasn't even until the point where they decided that they were going to stop processing game that people were bringing in to that particular shop, unless it was donations to that program. And I thought, donations? What's the program? I started looking it up, and that's how I discovered this whole universe. So there's a huge knowledge barrier, and I think word of mouth and people talking about this and you know, sharing it with their friends and things like that, you know, there's a huge opportunity there, because you know, this is a ministry, and a lot of these other organizations, they're nonprofits also, and they don't have, you know, huge marketing budgets to go on TV or to advertise through all these big channels to let people know this is out there. You know, it's got to be people telling other people that this is happening, this is a need, these places are around, or if they're not around, we can start one, we can get one up and running, we can help be part of the solution for feeding people. We can become a volunteer coordinator. You know, people need to talk about it. They got to vocalize it. They got to do podcasts just like this one, letting people know about the need and the opportunities to get involved. Because, I mean, I think people just take for granted that, oh, yeah, everybody knows about stuff. And, you know, if they want to participate, they can. But that's just, you know, not been my experience. Everybody thinks everybody knows everything about hunting. And of course, you know, the people who do know some things, they think they know everything about hunting. But the reality is there's so much knowledge that's just, it's not transferred. It's not passed on. There's no way to know unless people talk about it and they share about it and they talk about it at hunting camp and they talk about it with their family members and they donate a deer so that they can talk about, you know, they did that and the need, and they use that as a reason to share about it and let other people even in the local area know that this is happening, that this is a need, and that we can do something about it. And it's easy. It's not hard. It doesn't cost you anything. You bring a deer, you donate it. They take down, you know, where it came from so that, you know, they know it's legit and legal and they can share and all of that. And then this is going to help people. It's going to feed people. It's going to make a difference. And not just deer. You know, like we said, any big game, depending on the area, if your butchers process it, they can do that. And even livestock, you know, if you have a butcher that's willing to do that, the sky's the limit in terms of what could be donated, right?
Yep, that's pretty much true. Most of the deer and large game, one exception would be wild or feral hogs or any other animals that can carry trichinosis and other diseases where cooking and food safety could become a little bit more of an issue. Those are not recommended for donation by the health departments and different state agencies and things. So we don't use those. And then you get into sometimes like smaller game, fowl, fish. In many cases, since these are animals that are typically cleaned and prepared individually by hunters, you're just not going to find a processor or a plant that is equipped to handle them professionally. And so that's where, you know, a hunter could certainly still seek out an agency, maybe a rescue mission or some group that deals directly with their own food sourcing and prep on site that would be interested in some of those other kinds of animals and meat from those animals. But for the organized programs, sure, all the big game deer, elk, and then you get into the livestock types of deals. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity.
And if listeners are, you know, you live in an area where a certain kind of hunting is huge, maybe you live in a big waterfowl area under a major flyway, and you know, you guys take in scores of geese in a year, maybe you could find a processor who would be willing to work with that or something locally that made sense. But you know, in terms of getting something like this started, say somebody, they thought about, you know, they wanted more information about becoming a volunteer coordinator. How could they get involved?
Sure. Well, we're happy to talk with anybody. Our website's a good resource, fhfh.org. We have spots, different places on the site about becoming a volunteer, becoming a coordinator that will lead to some basic information, and then our contact info. Just got a couple of emails this past week from people wanting to know more about that side of things. So we're always open to those conversations and we'll see if it's a good fit. In some cases, if someone's just looking for a way to donate deer and they're not familiar and they ask about being a coordinator, well, if we find that maybe we already have a chapter nearby or another organization exists in that area, then we can make that connection for them. But in those cases where we come up empty and the only way they're going to be able to participate is if a chapter starts, then we have that conversation.
Of course. So, and of course, it doesn't cost anything to become a volunteer coordinator. You're not the one that has to do any donating. It's you're the one that coordinates, and you talk to the butchers, and you talk to local churches and businesses and maybe civic organizations, and you guys would help them do that, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. We've got materials and resources, and we're always open to developing new concepts and new material as well. A big part of what we're doing now is all of us, of course, are grappling with the transition from doing everything on paper to doing more things digitally. So we have opportunities for people to give that way, to become involved that way, email communication, online giving. It's all there, and we're trying to make more of those avenues available to our volunteers so that they in turn can share them locally and gather support in those ways.
Right. So the three main ways then people can get involved: they can donate a deer. That is the front line, number one way to help feed people. Number two, they can become a volunteer coordinator and help establish a local chapter, or maybe even assist a local chapter if there's one in their area. Yep. And number three, they could go onto your website and they could just make a straight monetary donation to help process deer and animals and livestock, maybe in areas that are underfunded or new and upcoming, or, you know, sometimes there's just a surge of need and, you know, the local chapter is not able to come up with the resources, but your gift can help go towards filling in the gap and feeding people. And, you know, you could become a supporter individually or even as a business.
Absolutely. Yep. That's exactly right. We have partnering sponsors, companies that get on board with larger contributions, all the way down to folks making a first-time gift or maybe setting up a monthly gift that recurs. So all of that is crucial to making this work.
Gotcha. And you guys have some, you know, significant organizations that have or do play some part and help you guys in various roles, right? I mean, I just want to make the point to people, this is not some startup fly-by-night operation. I mean, these guys are really after this and focused on it, and they've got the credibility to show for it.
Sure, yeah. And that's a testament to some of the companies and organizations in the hunting and shooting sports industries, that they recognize that this is an important way for hunters to give back, an important way and opportunity to show the general public all the good that hunters can do, the service that they can provide. So yeah, we have groups like the Bass Pro and Cabela's Outdoor Fund that are supportive, NRA Hunters for the Hungry. They provide information for people looking for butchers to donate to, and they provide the opportunity now for organizations to get some subsidy funding, grant funding through their program. So those are just two. You know, Matthews and Mission Archery in the archery world have always been supportive of this kind of work. And then your companies like Mossy Oak and, you know, of course they cover everything from camouflage to video and media and internet, types of news and stories and what have you. So, and they're just the tip of the iceberg. So many organizations and companies, not just supporting us, but supporting some of the other groups that do the same kind of work. So it really is a community effort from big industry all the way down to us as individuals that organize things and the hunters that donate and the people that give financially. And that's great. I mean, we're going to need to be looking for ways to help others. I think COVID, go back to COVID for just a moment, it gave all of us a little taste at how one unexpected turn of events at the national or global level can affect everything. You know, people were going to the grocery store and there was no meat in the meat counter, no toilet paper on the racks. And we said these news stories about this. That was just a little taste of how, I guess, how fragile we really are as people, and how we need to be equipped and ready to help one another at the local level and to find and source our food and other needs and not be dependent on big industry or even a government, because who knows, things come along, it's out of our control. And I think even as Christians, we know that things are out of our hands, that we rely on the grace and benevolence of a loving creator. But there are things in this world that are far beyond our control that seek to cause us harm, that can impact our lives in tremendously negative ways. And those are the times that we need to be ready to help one another, and especially help those in our communities that are unable to provide for themselves or don't have the knowledge. So there again, even as your listeners and viewers are learning about the sport of hunting, they're picking up a skill, picking up an ability to do something that not everybody in the community has, to source your own meat from the local lands. And so anyway, who knows? All I'm saying is there's a lot that goes into this. There's a lot of moving parts. If we all do our part and all play the role that we are led to play, a lot of great things can happen.
You know, you speak the truth. I remember the day I was at the grocery store, purposely went to the nicest, biggest, most prestigious grocery store in the area, and the meat counter was empty. There was nothing back there. And I will probably never forget the look in people's eyes when they pushed a cart of ground meat out from the back. And just people just swarmed around this cart of ground meat. And they just had this look in their eyes like, you know, everybody else, look out, I'm getting some. And I remember sitting there realizing, yeah, that's fine. I don't need any ground meat. I've got more ground venison in my freezer than I'll probably be able to eat before the next deer comes in. And then I started thinking later, I was like, man, what about people that aren't in that position? People that don't have their own meat, people that aren't able to come to this grocery store and pay top dollar and, you know, huddle around this circle and fight everybody else off to get some ground meat. What about the people that don't have the resources? Like, what are they eating right now? You know, how are they feeding their families? You know, what's happening at the food banks right now? Like, what is going out to people? If this is what's happening in the most prestigious grocery store in the town, where everything's the most money, but they have the most of it, and this is, you know, you got people standing in a circle fighting each other over a cart of ground beef, what's happening to people that don't have resources? And it just, you know, it's something that I think is always going to stick with me. But, you know, that need was always been there. And you guys have, you know, I saw on your website maybe somewhere around 100 or 150, you know, different participating butchers or areas or chapters or so on. Guys, they need to be having thousands. There needs to be thousands of these chapters across the country. You know, there are whitetails and other game in basically every state that can be plentifully hunted on a regular basis, and that, you know, the need is just so big. You know, I pushed Josh to do some name dropping just to show you guys the credibility here, but, you know, nothing about this is sponsored. You know, it's just the sheer cause of this that's pushing us forward. And, you know, some of these organizations, they do help, but the need just drastically outpaces the resources that anyone's able to contribute to this. This is something that everybody needs to be a part of. Every hunter needs to be a part of. Everyone in every community needs to be a part of. Not saying you've got to donate every deer, you need to donate, you know, at any particular rate, but it's something that we all need to be aware of and play a part in. You know, we can give online, we can put money into this thing to help fund. You know, in some areas, I'd be sure that, you know, if a coordinator was just able to go to a butcher and say, don't worry about it, we've got the resources already under control, it would be much easier to start chapters versus trying to find the local support and take the time and the energy to do that. If the resources were available, I would imagine, you know, we could scale and grow this thing a lot faster. So I want to encourage people, you know, get engaged, get involved, check out the website, Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry. You can just Google that, or fhfh.org. Read some of the testimonies, read some of the stories, look at some of the figures, and just make it a point to say, I'm going to be aware of this. I'm going to engage in this at some level. Whatever I'm able to do, whatever makes sense for my situation, to be someone who's taking a step forward to help feed people, to help meet these needs, to help set an example even for their children and people that are coming behind us. I just feel like this is something everyone needs to have in the back of their mind and be looking for their opportunities to be involved. But Josh, is there anything else you know, top of mind, anything else in your heart, anything else you want to share and get in before we wrap up today? I want to make sure that, you know, I don't end on a monologue. I want to make sure you got the opportunity to say anything else you, that you've gotten and brought to the table today.
I think we've covered a lot of bases here today, George. And again, I appreciate the opportunity. I would just say that the what you mentioned earlier about the need to share this information with others, you know, we're just inundated with information today, whether it's, you know, used to be newspaper, then TV, but now internet, it's in our pockets and on our phones, coming from all directions. And there's so much information that at times it's hard to get a message out about something like our program. So many hunters, seasoned veteran hunters, that have no idea that this type of work exists, either with our group or another organization, or they have a misconception about how it works. Maybe they participated with an older program where they had to pay the bill, and that was an obstacle to them for donating their deer, the processing bill. And in most states, a lot of places now, our program and others are trying to do the work so that they don't have to pay that bill. So just getting that word out, sharing this opportunity with others, you know, that once someone hears about it, learns about it, checks it out, you know, pass that information on, because you never know who might be the next deer donor, the next financial supporter, the next volunteer that would start this kind of work in their own community.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I really thank you, sir, for coming on the show today. This is just such an important cause, and I think that, you know, everybody can play a role at some level. So guys, make sure you subscribe to this podcast, however you listen to podcasts. Really appreciate it. You know, if you leave a review on iTunes, that helps us get the show out and helps get this kind of content out to more people and just enables us to expand and do more. So that's, you know, one tiny way you can help. But head to the website, farmersandhunters.com, .org, FHFH.org. You can read all about it. You can watch videos. You can see stories and testimonies, and just, you know, get that in your consciousness and put that at the front of your mind and something you can share on Facebook and wherever else you go. So till next time, guys, I appreciate you. God bless you, and go get them in the woods.